So when you are laying out the probability pieces, and in my mind, I'm again, like Bob is, I'm trying to wrap my head around this a little bit. 90%, 85%, those are good probabilities. 75%, okay. 65% doesn't seem like a great number to me, when you're talking about, especially when you're talking about pretty large financial impacts that you're predicting there.
Yeah.
But the other piece of that, especially with the anything that has to do with Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements, how much are you building in the federal question there too? Because it's not just on the state end whether or not the state is going to say this is okay. It's whether or not we're going to have some of these reimbursements at the federal end even. If you build that in. But the bigger piece, I guess, for me in wrapping my head around it, what does 65% really mean?
So in terms of the clinic optimization, there was two pieces of that recommendation. The first is the essentially the 340B discount drug program, and we assumed a benefit of around $320,000 of that $810,000 for the 340B program. It's a program where it gets into a lot of technical detail, but essentially safety net providers can pick up additional dollars from having their patients go to pharmacies that have contracted as a contracted provider, and the safety net hospitals, such as Sitka Community Hospital, can benefit from it. About $320,000. This is one that most critical access hospitals across the country, anybody with provider-based clinics, so clinics like Mountainside Clinic, are picking up reimbursement all over, everywhere in the country you go. This is one of those that if you haven't done this yet, let's get going. It's time. And I got to tell you, the big industry pharma is not happy about this because this is a direct transfer of dollars from pharma to safety net providers. So a big piece of that is that $320,000. We developed an action plan today with the management, as Rob mentioned earlier, where we like to have that up and running by January 1st of this year. So that's a piece of that. The second piece of it is we assumed we were able to increase our clinic volume by about 2,500 visits, so up from 10,000 to about 12,500 visits. And a lot of that was around the growth in the urgent care clinic. It was additional services that could be billed for, including these new transitional care codes and chronic care management codes. It was doing more well visits and calling patients. Matter of fact, the management team's action plan they developed this afternoon was around growing from instead of 12,500 visits, instead of growing to 2,500, they think by the end of next year, or the end of this fiscal year, they could actually grow visits by 5,000 visits. So we've only modeled in 2,500. And between those two, it's pretty good probability that we're gonna get this. We've got plenty of physician and nurse practitioners and physician assistant supply. And it's just a matter of kind of ramping up the volume in those clinics. Yeah.
Speaking to that a little bit, what percentage of Sitka would you say uses a hospital now, Sitka Community?
So the only number we have on that is Medicare. So one of the things that we looked at was Medicare inpatient market share. So Medicare, you're over 65 population. And at this point, I'm trying to remember, I believe it was 22% of Sitka residents that have an inpatient admission in 2015 received that at Sitka Community Hospital. 26% of those Sitka residents received their inpatient care at Mount Edgecombe Hospital, and the rest are leaving Sitka, whether they're going to Juneau or Anchorage or Seattle. And so clearly there's an opportunity to keep more people in this community. I will say in 2011, that combined percent was 63%. So if you combine Mount Edgecombe Medicare inpatient volume and Sitka. The combined was about 63%. That number, I believe, dropped down to about 47%. So in last, you know, between 2011 and 2015, we lost, what, about 7, I'm terrible with numbers, 17% of we lost a pretty significant piece of Medicare inpatients going out of town to get inpatient care.
Well, it makes sense when you look at the growth in Medivacs in the last decade. It's astronomical.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my follow-up question. Yeah. So 50% of people who end up being inpatients are leaving via Medivac or some other means, whether it be by choice or Medivac. Is that what you're saying?
That's,
so what I heard you just say is accumulatively, both search and sick community account for 47% of overall admissions.
And this was 2015.
For people that live here.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, but this is only
Medicare
recipients, so those over 65. And I assume this includes a lot of people with selective surgeries for orthopedics and such that go south for that. So, please.
So, I mean, what real opportunity do we have to keep them here if the services aren't provided, though? I mean, I think that's the big question that ends up looming out there. Because
well, the good news is we did not model any of keeping more inpatients in Sitka into this projection. We just didn't model that in. There's other areas where we can kind of have an input to create an output that specifically benefits our bottom line. And there's, you know, kind of more services that essentially complement the total delivery system here. Long-term care, you know, rehab, home health, these are all opportunities for us.
Can I follow on the increase in clinic visits? A question's been asked in the past. How do you predict or project impacts when you close OB services while there aren't all that many loss of actual children and maybe just the mom? A lot of times families follow with. The entire family goes to a clinic. So how do you project or predict those impacts?
Well, a couple of things. When the, you know, over the last 15 years, we tried to pull the count of it. We were not able to get it. But of critical access hospitals that have discontinued their OB programs, generally when a critical access hospital discontinues an OB program, they continue to provide the prenatal care, you know, after the baby's born. What they give up is the delivery itself. And generally, you want to have deliveries consolidated where you can have enough scale where the nurses can be trained at the highest level possible, given the community and things like that. So you really want to have some economies of scale just to have it a safer service. So what we're just talking about, we're not talking about giving up the prenatal or post delivery. This is really just talking about the delivery itself.
I guess just to kind of jump onto Kevin's comment, I'm just curious about kind of when you're looking at, you know, kind of what typically happens across rural critical care access hospitals.
Yeah.
I mean, is it typical for a rural community such as ours to have two hospitals? So like in this case, you know, if you're in a community, rural community with only one hospital, you'll continue to get that prenatal care there, whereas maybe here you have two options, so you could get that prenatal care at the same place that would do the delivery. I don't know if that, I mean, basically, you know, is it that common to see a rural community such as ours have more than one critical access hospital?
It's not. I will also say that there, you know, if you look at, I think, Parker, Arizona, where you have a critical access hospital a mile down the road from an Indian Health Service hospital. And so, the reason why we can have that is because when CMS looks at whether they'll give a critical access hospital that designation, right, to meet the federal distance criteria of 15 miles on secondary roads or 35 miles on primary roads, they give exceptions because when they see an Indian Health Service hospital, a tribal hospital, and a non-tribal critical access hospital providing services to different populations. So you know, it's, you guys are very unique in that you are a small island community that has two hospitals. Absolutely. The closest I could get, like I said, is Parker, Arizona, where you have a community with two hospitals, and one of them being the Indian Health Service Hospital, one being the Critical X Hospital.
How big is Parker, Arizona?
It's not very big. We had two of our staff were there. Do you remember, Jonathan? Did you look at that number? We can get you that. We literally just did a study in that community 3 or 4 months ago.
And I'm assuming maybe that in that particular location, the Parker Indian Health Center only serves beneficiaries, or does it serve the entire community, like search?
I'm not sure. But if you want, we can get you that information. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, you guys are very unique.
And to speak to the service in the Phoenix area and Indian healthcare in Arizona is
very different.
Yeah, night and day. I've spent time down there, and I brought my son in to a clinic, and we left. So I don't think it's a fair comparison in either the East or West Valley from what I've seen, but just for the record anyway.
I have another question here. This $550,000 per year for facility repairs, basically capital expenditures, this is included in the hospital's budget. This is coming from hospital funds, not additional
So what
funds.
We did is this was the number that was built into the 10-year projection. So every year we assumed an additional investment in capital and equipment of $550,000. And that was in over and above the $2.9 million that was going to be the Cerner acquisition cost.
Okay.
I can show you how it plays out in the model here if you want. I've still got about 14 slides.
Yeah.
But at least it's not 100.
I guess I missed the answer to that question because that was something that I was thinking about too. Is that from actual hospital revenues, or is that additional dollars that are brought, that are asked for from the city?
Well, it's funded out of the operations. So what we left alone in the model was the tobacco tax and the, I think there's some additional capital in built into the model.
$150,000.
So we left that constant. But I think what you're going to have to see is when we get to the model, see what happens to the cash and then decide if we need to continue to do that.
Thank you for answering our questions.
You want to go on?
Right, page 4.
We're going to swap in the 100-page report here in a minute. So,
I just had a quick question on 340B.
Yes, sir.
What impact would that have on our local pharmacies?
Actually, in other rural communities, it's actually been able to benefit them. And because generally when a 340B eligible organization like a critical access hospital can buy the drugs at the federal pricing level, they can buy drugs at half the cost. And so there's often what happens is there's enough money in the drug savings because they're able to buy it at the federal government pricing level that there's enough money that the internal pharmacy can actually share in a little bit of that as well by through the filling fee. So they're going to get paid a filling fee. If the filling fee today they're getting is $15, often you see communities increase that. The 340B eligible hospital, like a critical access hospital, will bump that amount up to $22 or $25 a visit. So there's just new money in the system, and it's really new money in the community.
Matt, I'm sorry, I've got two more questions on this. How in your model, how are the surgical services going to be staffed?
Staffed daytime scheduled surgery.
No, travelers, on site, people living in Sitka.
Yeah, on site. So, are you staffed from the doctor's perspective?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The way we have the models today. I mean, obviously, there's been some transition there. So, whatever the model is going forward, it would be staffed with Sitka physicians and Sitka surgical staff.
Thank you.
Just one more question.
Just
we can
one
move
more
on here. So you kind of answered my question, but what's really sticking in my mind is I'm curious if we lined everyone up on a wall in Sitka and asked them to raise their hand if you get service at Sitka Community, what percentage of those people would raise their hands?
Yeah.
Self-funded, doesn't, do we know?
I can't, I we don't have that information. We don't have that information. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem, just thought I would ask.
Yeah. It's just not available. Some states have it, but we don't have it here in Alaska, that information. So why don't we just kind of walk through this pretty quickly, the rest of the slides? Again, we little talked about this. We were engaged to look at the organization from a strategic, financial, and operational perspective. And we built what we saw into a financial model. And obviously the purpose was to identify, you know, a go-forward model given tweaks in the organizations that we could present to you. The things that we looked at demand for services. We looked at, you know, where what we see in best practice rural hospitals are doing versus, you know, opportunities. So ultimately, when we were looking at your operation, we've got to go see 300, 350 small rural hospitals. What we like to do is take best practices from them and share them with you. And so our basis of analysis is all of our experiences traveling around the country. We looked at reimbursement. We looked at, and through the cost report, through your revenue cycle. We looked at your expenses, and then the strategic direction. And all of this was incorporated into this 100-page report that I imagine you'll see as soon as the board finalizes that. The project involved us before we got on site. We had a whole bunch of information presented and sent to us. Cynthia and her team pulled together all kinds of information. We were able to build that into some models. We crunched some data. We came on site. We spent 2 days meeting with as many people. Some of Steve met with you, and I know John, you met with Bob. And so we met with a number of people, both assembly members, board members, medical staff, hospital leaders. We went back, we prepared the financial analysis, the 100-page report that was presented to the board last Friday night and again yesterday. And out of that came this shorter version of that report. So, but what you'll see is that literally these were just this 14 or 15 slide presentation with an appendix were just slides cropped out of that report without any changes to it. And you'll notice that when you get the longer version of the report. So we did action planning today. That was exciting. As Rob mentioned, we had 30 managers of the hospital spend all day today actually going through the report and helping to identify other opportunities in this 100-page report that they could actually do something about and develop specific action plans that are going to be implemented over a 6 to 12 month period that go beyond what we've modeled into this. And then we're always available for any help. The financial assessment, this is where we start to look at the financial model itself. Obviously, 10-year projection. We use fiscal year 2016 as the basis for it. And then we modeled in essentially 10 months of 2017 data annualized is to begin the assessment. And then we ran that out 9 years past 2017. We used a status quo, and we compared it individually to each of the five opportunities that we talked about on the second slide. And then we combined all five of those opportunities and presented those as if we could achieve all of them and what would be the impact on the bottom line. Just a little bit of the assumptions before we get into it. Everyone wants to know what the assumptions are. You know, some revenue assumptions. We assumed we were going to increase price 2%. We assumed bad debt was at 2.25% of gross charges. We assumed Medicare would continue to pay on a cost basis. And as far as we see coming out of Washington, D.C., there's no one going after critical access hospitals in Congress. And it literally would take an act of Congress to kind of take down the cost-based reimbursement part of critical access hospitals. We assumed other payers would be paid at similar rates as to what we're getting paid now over time, and we assumed volumes would remain constant throughout all 10 years of the projection, with the exception of the changes built in these five initiatives. We assumed other operating revenue at the fiscal year 2017 amount, and then we did assume the tobacco tax remained at what it was in 2017, and that the capital, the SICA support for fixed assets remained at $153,000, which was what it was received in 2016, and then we just assumed that trend for the projection period. In terms of expense assumptions, we assumed salaries and wages were going to increase about 2% a year. Professional fees were going to increase 3% a year. We assumed the benefit expense, the PERS benefit, and other benefits would be around the same, which were about 52% of wages, which, based on what we see in rural hospitals around the country, is about twice what we normally see. So clearly a benefit expense is significantly higher than what we're used to seeing. And then we assumed staffing at equivalent levels. Clearly we wanted to point to the fact that we were going to make some investments in the electronic health record in 2019, and that our capital costs would be around $550,000 a year, as we've talked about already. This next slide is the red line. Do you have a color copy? Yeah, you do have a color copy. The red line shows your cash at the end of the year at the current state, status quo. So if we did nothing to impact our operations, cash goes negative out in a few years, and then it continues down on a negative trend to about $7 million negative by 2026. And that was based on the blue line, which is the projected net income or change in position throughout the projection period. You can't continue to maintain positive cash when you're losing, you start to lose $1.3, $1.4 million a year. And that's what this shows.
So what we're seeing is days cash on hand going negative over 10 years.
Correct.
Basically.
Yeah.
Is this based on the current budget?
Yeah, so this was based on 2016 actual information in which we modeled in the cost report, trended forward for 2017, 10 months year-to-date annualized, and then we set that at status quo, and again, made assumptions that we just went in the two prior pages around expense assumptions going up 2% or 3%, charge increases going up 2%, and the assumptions on the previous two pages.
Thank you.
And... regarding the expenses and benefits, what are you programming in for annual health insurance increases?
That was, for employees? I believe we assumed that around a 3% increase per year.
Okay. Tristan, sorry.
I'm wondering if you're even potentially sick of community hospital, have we gone back in time beyond 2016? And I'm thinking about the fact that assemblies over the last 10 years or whatnot, every few years have had to inject, a million and a half in capital into the hospital. So has this trend kind of been happening for a while, and then we'll get a little infusion of city money that gets it back up, but it's still kind of... been trending, or I don't know if we've done that kind of analysis at all.
We in the larger 100-page report, we looked at the financial position going back to 2013. And unfortunately, it gets goofy in 15 and 16 because of the PERS and the recognition of the GASB 68 adjustment, where there was in-kind money from the state and your pension benefit went through the roof and some things that you're probably all familiar with. So it got a little bit of goofy, but we didn't go back beyond 2013 and look at the results. This literally assumed where we were in 2017 through 10 months was going to be, we're going to lock that in, and then the only thing that was going to change was the assumption changes that we talked about in the first two pages of this, the financial section, and then the modeling of these five scenarios.
Thank you. Yeah, and I wasn't sure that that may be just me kind of asking the question out loud. Yeah. If this was a trend that's been going on for a decade or more, and you know, in the past when state money was flowing, we were able to do those kind of things. But at this point, we finally said, like, this isn't it. You know, we can't continue to operate in this downward trend. And anyways, just kind of maybe thinking out loud.
I mean, what I would have liked to see if we could have waited until the end of this fiscal year, because the last 2 months of this year, May and June, the hospital had record performance from revenue generated and through cash received. And a lot of that was the strategic initiative to redevelop the long-term care program, where the census was at 10 in 2016 and is now back up to around 14. So you had a 40% increase in your long-term care patient days. Our home health volume has more than doubled in the last year alone. We've seen increases in our physical therapy program, we're at record highs of physical therapy. So we're seeing a lot of things right now that if we would have modeled out just the last 2 months and into that set to 17 annualized, I think we would even have seen a stronger performance as a base year.
Yeah, and I think my question is probably more leading up to that, the last infusion of capital in 2014, when we set, kind of recognized there's an issue here with operations and we need to change something. So recognizing that we have made some adjustments since 2014 to try to make things sustainable.
And you're really going to start to see them pay off in the change in your bottom line.
And also this the status quo includes the tobacco tax and capital support from the city that's currently received.
Correct.
Kind of flatlined.
Right.
And then does not include additional capital expenditures from hospital operations. So we're still deferring maintenance and subsidizing. Yeah,
so this right here is looking at just your statement of operations.
Yeah.
The next is looking at your change in cash flow.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But to answer your question, yes, it does include that $550,000 in this base case scenario, and it also includes the $2.9 million for the Cerner. So that is included in this projection of where the hospital is going over time.
Okay, so that's changes over the status quo, then that's
It does include that $550,000 through 2026, and it does include the $2.9 million in 2019. So that's in this base case as a part of that cash projection.
So it's better than I thought at first glance. So thank you.
Okay.
That is good.
So I'm just going to go back to slide 12. So this is, again, this is your statement of operations, your income statement as we think of it. And essentially what it shows is that your accumulated net assets dropped to negative $18 million, completely unsustainable. And then how that plays out from a cash flow perspective on slide 13 is, as we talked about, your cash goes negative to the tune of around $7 million by the time you play out the 10-year projection period. Again, unsustainable. This slide is ultimately saying if we were to implement all five of the recommendations that we discussed on the first slide, the top graphic shows that the red bar is the net income of Sitka Community Hospital in each of the years, assuming implementation of the five scenarios. The blue line is the status quo. Without implementation of these five initiatives, what is our bottom line? What does our net income look like? Pretty big spread. The graphic at the bottom shows the impact on the cash. The red line is the cumulative cash position over 10 years with implementation of the five scenarios, and the blue is the cumulative cash position of the organization assuming status quo and not implementing, with the $550,000 cash in capital and the $2.9 Cerner investment.